Member-supported Jazz 90.1 proudly welcomes you to America's longest-running computer show, Soundbites. Call the show now at 966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll-free 800-790-0415 or soundbites.org. Now, alongside Steve Ray and Dave Enright, here's Nick Francesco on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Good afternoon, Mr. and Mrs. America, and all the chips in the PC. It is Saturday, the 16th day of March. My cat's birthdays. Anno Domini 2024, and you, you lucky people, you're listening to Sound Bites. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Steve Ray.
And in 5 minutes after the hour, we are going to be bringing you news, views, things to choose, nothing to lose. Kick off your shoes. Don't get the blues. Have you paid your dues? Here comes the news. There are probably several reasons, although I don't know what they are, to use Windows 11, Bing, and Copilot AI. But Microsoft still finds it necessary to spam users with unnecessary pop-ups. After ditching the effort last year, Microsoft is again pestering Chrome users on Windows to switch their search engine setting to Bing. You may have noticed that a few days ago, Microsoft added shady-looking QR codes to the Windows 11 lock screen, sending users to the download page for its Copilot AI assistant. After lots of backlash, the company paused that rollout. We saw something similar last summer with the company aggressively employing Bing pop-ups in the taskbar, begging people to ditch Google search on Chrome and switch to Bing. Now it looks like those same frustrating pop-ups are back. It looks like once again Microsoft flipped the server-side switch and will nudge those on Windows 10 and 11 using Google Chrome to switch to Bing and enjoy Copilot AI. Apparently, this is a one-time notification, and that's in quotes, that encourages users to switch to Bing for search.
Yeah, right.
The malware-like pop-up inside Chrome teases access to GPT-4 and the ability to enjoy, and I quote, hundreds of daily chat turns with Bing AI. If a user taps yes on the pop-up, it'll change Chrome settings, search settings to Bing. Then, if you go to switch back, you'll again be notified and warned that you'll lose access to Bing AI with GPT-4 and DALL-E 3. The first time we got this pop-up, it wasn't quite as targeted, but now Microsoft is using the allure of AI to convince users to switch. It's pretty funny, considering the product does a great job of selling itself, thanks to the never-ending flow of new features and Copilot goodies. However, for whatever reason, Microsoft continues to resort to comical and almost shady practices like this. So if you're browsing the web on Chrome on Windows, don't be alarmed if you see an alert from Microsoft to give Bing another shot. To be fair, this is a never-ending battle that both Google and Microsoft partake in. Either way, it's starting to get rather frustrating, not to mention annoying and just a little bit desperate. So our poll of the week at soundbites.org, that is Bites with a Y, Francis would like us to remind you, is Microsoft is dunning us to switch to Bing. Your choices are, oh, I love Bing. Yeah, I've seen it. Google search forever, baby. Neither Google nor Bing search, thanks. And, meh, doesn't matter which one I see, which one I use. So far, we've got 23 votes in the poll, and Google search forever, baby, is just ahead of neither Google nor Bing search, thanks. And, of course, you can vote at the poll. It's pretty easy. Just head on over to soundbites.org. That is Bites with a Y, Francis would like us to remind you. And of course, if you have anything to say about that or dang me or anything else under the sun, give us a call. 585-966-JAZZ. It's 966-5299. Toll free 800-790-0415.
The one I always hate is I'm in Microsoft Edge and I go to the Chrome download website and Edge pops up and says, "Are you sure?"
Yeah.
Edge is so much better.
Yeah. I love it because I got a notice a long time ago when I got that other PC when the one died on me. Oh, this machine doesn't qualify for Windows 11. I'm going, yeah!
Well, the other thing that's happening now is apparently an EU law just took effect. And so we had a customer bring a machine in. I forget what country it was from. But it had a browser picker. So now in the EU, the first time you turn your computer on, you have to pick what browser you're using. And you get... Edge and Chrome and Firefox, plus browsers local to your company, country. And you know, we're hearing from people saying, I don't know. What's a browser?
Right.
I just want to get on the internet. What's a browser?
No, and I get it. But, you know, people, look, it's like I keep saying, it's a tool. Like a car is a tool. You don't have to know how to change anything inside your car. You don't even need to know what a spark plug is to drive a car.
Right.
You don't need to know how to do anything inside a computer to use a computer, except when they bring you, and these are fairly simple questions, like, do you want to switch your browser?
Mm-hmm.
You have to know what a browser is, and I get that.
Every industry has its own special terms.
Right.
And unfortunately, you might have to learn a few.
Then also people that don't take the time, as we've said, for years, that people get click happy, and all of a sudden they wind up with all those GD toolbars, and you say, you know, and they're taking up 3/4 of their screen, and you're going, what's all these toolbars? Yeah. I didn't do it.
Yeah, how'd they get on there?
Oh.
Well, you inadvertently installed them.
No, I didn't.
No, I didn't.
Mm-hmm.
Someone using your computer did it. I'm the only one using it. Then you did it.
And you did it.
Inadvertently, you didn't read a screen that went by. And
Yeah, you got click happy.
Yeah.
And agreed to all this other garbage that you're downloading onto your machine and slowing it down. And we just cleaned it up for you. You take it home and do all that stuff. And then it's running slow again, and then you try to blame us for being running slow again.
Right.
I've got a customer at a medical office, and their X-ray machine host computer crashed. And so I'm running diagnostics, and I get a smart failure on the hard drive. And then the woman that takes the X-ray says, oh, yeah, I've been getting that error for months.
Huh?
And you just click right past it. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and there's nothing you can do about that.
Yep. No explaining stupid.
Yep.
So we were able to put an external hard drive on it, get it back up and running. Well, we lost some X-rays. Maybe. We're working on it.
Where's your backups?
Yeah. And now it was a Seagate Exos Enterprise drive when we put it in the server just under 3 years ago, because it's got a 3-year warranty.
Yeah.
Seagate is saying, we're not going to warranty it. Contact the vendor you bought it from.
Huh? We're the vendor they bought it from.
Yeah, and we bought it through distribution at Ingram. And so Ingram's not going to cover it.
Right. That's we're seeing that a lot. Companies, as long as they've got a finger to point at somebody else.
Faster than you can blink.
Now, I bought a couple of weeks ago the saga of my brother printer. I bought a brother printer.
You were so excited.
I was so excited. And it showed up, and I got the print unable 0B error. So I looked at it, and I saw that there was the corona wire that heats the roller was broken. Okay, that's never going to print. There is no way you fix this.
Nope. Mm-hmm.
So I got online and I chatted with them, and I, you know, first they got to go through their script. So when did you buy it? Two days ago. What's the serial number? Send us the receipt.
Yada, yada, yada.
Okay. Okay, fine. I did all of that. I knew I was going to have to do all that, so I had it already sitting on my desktop.
There you go.
Cut and paste, and it was fine. Drag it over. It's fine. So finally I sent them a picture I had taken and circled the broken corona wire. And the lady even said, yeah, that's clearly it. We'll send you a new printer. I said, "But no, I don't need a new printer.
Just need the drum.
I just need a new drum.
Mm-hmm.
I don't even need new toner. I just need a new drum." She said, "No, we'll send you a brand new printer." Okay.
Yeah, whatever.
Fine.
Did you have to send the old one back?
So, well, that's a separate story.
Well, we're still
in the middle of that.
You keep that toner.
Exactly right. So they sent me a brand new printer. I took the old printer down. I unpacked the new printer. No drum kit. So this time I called.
The only piece you needed.
And they said, well, yeah, you just take the toner out. Listen to me. Here's the problem. So I had to go through the whole thing again. When did you buy it? It's all still on my desktop, so I just dragged it over. I sent them again the picture saying, oh, yeah, You should have that from the last time, Matt. The whole reason you asked for my incident number was so you could look it up. Yeah. And in fact, you even said, give me a minute while I read through the old stuff. She said, well, yes, we will send you out a toner and a drum kit. The kit, drum and toner kit, which is all one piece. I said, okay, fine. We'll send that right out. Now, the printer I got in 2 days. Drum kit, 2 days, I see. First you get an order placed, then you get an order confirmed, then you get an order shipped. Order placed happened within 4 minutes. 2 days later, order confirmed, back ordered. So
Which may explain why the replacement printer didn't have one in it.
What?
Which may explain why the replacement printer didn't have one in it. Maybe.
But, so 2 days ago, I just ordered one from Amazon. It'll be here this afternoon, so.
It's like I say, if it wasn't for bad luck, I'd have no luck at all.
Crackers. And like I keep saying, I buy refurbed computers and refurbed printers and refurbed everything all the time.
Yeah.
I never, ever have a problem with it. I buy a brand new printer.
See, that's what you do.
I set up three brand new printers.
They'll teach you.
I set up three brand new Brother printers last week, and everything went fine. In fact, one house I was scared because they said, yeah, the internet's down. Oh, no, I can't download a driver.
Right.
Fortunately, it was built into the Mac.
There you go.
Because they don't come with CDs anymore.
Mm-mm. Oh, the brothers do. The brother I got did.
The one I got didn't.
What good does it do? Because most PCs don't have CD ROMs.
That's right, true. Yeah.
And who knows when that CD was burned. The first thing you do is check for updates.
Yeah.
Exactly.
That's why it's better that they don't bother including it anyways. But, just go up to the web and get the latest and greatest.
Fortunately, their Wi-Fi was still on, even though it gave me connect to internet errors. I don't care. Wi-Fi from the computer to the router to the printer works.
Well, you could have
you should have been
able to tether it to your phone, right?
If you'd really needed to download the driver.
But I needed it so that I could download driver that way. Yeah.
Put it
join their printer to their Wi-Fi so they can print. Yep.
Yeah, that's all.
We've done that now.
Around the back door and in.
I'll make a hotspot with the same name as their network. Wi-Fi is stupid like that.
Yep.
If the network name is the same, it assumes the password is the same as the last time it saw that named network.
Yep. Exactly right.
Which helps when you replace a router in your house, give it the same Wi-Fi name and password as the old router, and then you don't have to go around to all 50 of your devices. To reconnect to Wi-Fi, your TVs, your thermostats, your speakers.
I did that when my Eero died, and I replaced it with a Google Nest Home, whatever they call it this week, mesh network. I gave it exactly the same username and password, and everything just appeared. One device didn't. I forget which one it was. It was an old machine, and it didn't come back up that I was doing some testing on. I just had to restart it. Big deal. But everything, because it's the same name and the same password, computers don't care. They just,
That's one thing, though, I got to admit that I love, you steered me to it, was the Orbi routers.
That is so easy
to set up.
Yeah.
And then for folks that have never done this, so you won't know maybe what I'm talking about. But when you set up a Raspberry Pi, it's got built-in wireless. And, you know, quite often you don't know what the Wi-Fi address is.
Right.
What's nice about the Orbi drive is I can go to the web page on my router and say, a device is hooked up. And it'll list all the devices that it knows on my network. And I can just scan down that list. I said, Raspberry Pi.
What do you mean I have 53 devices on my network?
Oh, please.
Oh, yeah, really.
Holy moly.
Tablets and, like you say, phones and all this other stuff. And I just scroll down the list and, Raspberry Pi. There's the address. So I can
How do you tell the difference between all your other Raspberry Pis?
I give them different names. Yeah. That's one
it's
thing
the
I.
New one.
Yeah.
I sit there, because otherwise I've got it marked as server one, server two, work Pi, and I keep them straight that way. But any new one, like I say, you don't know.
Right. just comes up as Raspberry Pi, and you find the address, and you
know. Because I made a list.
That's irrational.
And by the way, you can also do ifconfig, and it will tell you the IP address and the MAC address.
Yep.
But yeah, it's the one thing I dislike about Google Home, it is so easy to set up. I mean, it is ludicrously simple to set up. But the one thing I don't like about it is you have to use your phone. There's no web page.
Same thing with the Eero.
Yeah.
And I can see how they're targeting at home users who don't have technical skill.
Yep. I get that. But I would love of us who do.
Yeah. I would love to find a DHCP table.
Yes.
No, there's just a list of connected devices.
Yep.
What's each one's IP address? You have to go into each one separately.
Yep. Oh. I don't like it. I'll be interested in seeing, now that I'll hopefully be able to actually boot up my printer, there should be a web page in it. And I should be able to see what that's like. So
one of the things we run into now and then at work with our Eeros, we have a guest network for customers to use while they're waiting. Every now and then we run out of IP addresses. Because we're only on V4, so we have 250 addresses.
Right.
So after 2 or 3 months, it's run through. Because these other, the other ones have fallen off because they didn't come back yet. But it's maybe they'll be back.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So
it's waiting.
We have to restart the router every few months, which is not a bad idea anyway.
No.
Well, you should be able to just release the addresses.
Not in the Eero software.
Well,
there's,
okay, all
there's
right.
no DHCP table.
No, it's good in the sense that, you know, you have to do that every so often, because then if you get in the habit of also checking for any updates to software, you kind of get in that mode. You can also just have a quick, you know, check for any software updates, firmware updates, and all that to your router, and then have it do the reboot.
Yep.
So and
by the way,
kind of a dual purpose.
That's a good little call right now. As long as you're sitting at home listening to this show, you might want to think about checking to see if there's updates to your equipment, not just your computers, but your printer, your router, your tablets, your watch. There was just a big update to Pixel phones, and it was 700-odd meg, 768, I think, meg. And it was a big one, and there's a lot of new stuff. And so, and of course, we just had Patch Tuesday. We'll talk about that when we come back. So things should be updating over the next day or two. So make sure you've got yourself up to date, because I know everybody wants to wait for somebody else to update. But the reality is, the way the world works today, there are a lot of zero-day exploits. And if you don't update right away, you are vulnerable. And when you are vulnerable, you will get hit, because it's not people checking for vulnerabilities anymore. It's computers, and they check fast.
Right. And so it doesn't matter if you don't have anything worth stealing, or it doesn't matter, because the computer is going to find your address. So it's like that. They're going up and down the street. There's house here, house here, house here, house here. Looks at every single house. And if I can steal $5 from this one, great. If I can steal $1 from that one, great.
And if I can't steal anything, I can put porn on it and serve it to somebody else.
Or I can use that to hide my attack on the next street over.
Exactly. So, you know, whether or not you have anything worth stealing, you have a computer worth stealing.
Or computer time.
Right. Exactly. Yep. So definitely get yourself updated. All right. To the phones. Our next caller is Fred from Rochester, New York. Hiya, Fred. What's up?
Good afternoon, gentlemen.
Good afternoon.
I finally got my Raspberry Pi 400.
Nice.
The first one was never found, so I reordered it from a different seller, and it was there in a couple of days. So I want to set it up for my daughter, because she is a volunteer at Lollipop Farm, and she does presentations, and Google Slides doesn't give the option that I can find, or she could find, the option to set a timer for your slides to automatically roll through. Leave the Office does have it. So that's kind of one of the reasons I got the Raspberry Pi 400, was to do the LibreOffice thing. And much to my surprise, it came already installed.
Yep.
I've got it hooked up to my 27-inch screen, and it's I had to make adjustments for all the picture sizes, all the everything was real tiny. I had to be right on top of it.
Looks like there's a timer plug-in option where you can insert a slide timer plug-in to Google Slides.
Okay, didn't
this Google Slides. I beg your pardon.
No, I'm looking at I'm looking at Libre Slides now. I mean, I got it running. That's the reason I got the other machine.
Right, that one has under slide. You can set transition and pick a time.
Yeah. It says rehearse. It's real simple. You go rehearse timing, and you click on the time clock when you want it to switch, and it remembers all that, and then you're done. So, one of the things I want to do with this machine is put in Revo One installer. I don't see a Revo One installer for Raspberry.
There isn't one.
Okay, and I got some kind of error message when I tried to install my NPass.
What error message did you get?
Well, it says error page, Chromium. It says NPass, the system is unable to connect with the NPass app. You could not find NPass desktop app installed. Maybe I did the wrong download.
Sounds like it.
Okay.
Well, it depends on what
download.
You got the one for Linux,
or the one for specifically for the Raspberry Pi.
There isn't one specifically for the Raspberry Pi.
Okay, maybe I didn't. Okay, I got portable Linux.
Yeah,
I see Mac, I see Windows, and I see three options for portable. It's not really portable.
Right. Well, okay, let me go back a bit. Let me start with let me answer your first question for Google Slides.
Okay.
There is an auto advance for Google Slides.
Okay, I have to look that up.
In the top right corner, you can click Slideshow. And at the bottom of that, there's Options. And one of the choices after that is auto advance options, and you can set a time. Most people don't set that because they want to talk about a slide and then hit the space bar and move it manually. But you can do it automatically with the slideshow option.
Okay. I'll have to look up. I'll have to look for that later. But I did pull down a sample that it was made on Google Slides, and I can download it to the Raspberry, and I can play it through LibreOffice, which works perfectly. I don't have to go through any other steps. Just click on it.
Right.
Which I love. You didn't. By the way, you didn't give an option of when what now?
Yeah, right.
That would have been my pick, but then what?
Yeah, right.
But I'm trying to do NPass, and is there a alternative Revo One installer for Linux?
Generally not, because it is not the same. The reason you need Revo One installer is because the Windows uninstaller doesn't remove things from the
registry.
And Revo One installer does. In Linux, there is no registry. There are configuration files. And when you uninstall something, it removes the config files.
Oh, great. Okay.
If you say purge. Mm-hmm. If you just say uninstall, it may leave the config file. If you say purge, it will then remove the config file as well.
Okay.
So you don't need a Revo One installer for that.
Okay. Good enough.
All right. I'm sorry, I couldn't hear you. The music was too loud.
Can we do the NPass after commercial?
Yeah, stay on the line. We're going to take a quick break. Back in just a couple of minutes with Dave Enright, Steve Ray, me, Nick Francesco, Fred from Rochester, and you. It is 29 minutes after the hour. You're listening to the longest running computer show in the known universe, Soundbites, right here on the truly great and truly grateful to you that we are member supported, Jazz 90.1. See you on the other side.
online 24 hours a day, 7 days a week at soundbites.org. More with Nick Francesco, Dave Enright, and Steve Ray next on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Steve Ray.
And at 35 minutes after the hour, we are Soundbites, and we have Fred on the line from Rochester, New York.
Yeah, still here.
All right, so let's talk about NPass. There is a portable version of NPass.
Okay.
For
Linux.
For Linux. Alternately, if what you're mostly worried about are websites, there is an extension for any Chrome-based browser or Firefox.
Okay.
And so,
Chromium?
Yeah, Chromium is a Chrome-based browser, yes.
Okay.
So, So yeah, you can install the extension.
I did.
And then what you have to do at some point is start. You have to set it up on, I think, if I remember correctly, you have to set it up on a regular computer first.
Oh.
And then you can use it on NPass. On the Chromium browser.
And that may be why you're getting the error message, can't connect to desktop.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. So what about the Linux portable one? Can I put that on this Raspberry Pi?
According to the folks at NPass, yes. Yes, you can.
Okay.
And it says right here that it can be used on Raspberry Pi and other devices. So the idea is you download it and you put it on a USB drive and you run it from there.
Oh, okay. Because I downloaded it and I'm trying to run it from the internal.
Oh, no. Read the docs. Read the docs at the portable version site, and that will tell you you have to run it from a USB drive.
How about just downloading the Linux version? Would that work?
I don't know. He said it wouldn't. It didn't.
Okay.
Yeah, it gave me some kind of error that.
I honestly haven't tried it on a computer.
And it says it's only tested on CentOS, Fedora, and Ubuntu.
Yeah. So if you're running Ubuntu on your Raspberry Pi, it should work. But if you're running our Raspberry Pi's own OS, it might not.
All right. It's a Raspbian.
Sorry.
What am I running? I got Raspbian. Is that
Raspbian is it's based on Debian, and so is Ubuntu, but they are not the same.
Okay.
French? Yeah, okay. French, and Canadian French.
French.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I get
it. New Orleans French.
Yeah, New Orleans French, yeah.
Configuration, Raspberry Pi configuration would tell me what.
Right.
Okay.
Should. Also, are you the Fred from the cookies?
Yeah.
God love you. We love you.
Glad you loved them.
Yes, they were great.
My daughter, I told you, volunteers for Lollipop, and we are both vegan.
Yep.
And so were the cookies.
Yes,
they were phenomenal.
They were delicious. Sorry, Steve missed them.
No, we're not.
No, we're not.
For you.
We enjoyed them. He should have had his butt here.
Yeah, there you go. Well,
snooze, you lose.
Maybe another day.
But no, thank you, Fred. We very much appreciate it. Let us know how that all works out.
Okay, I'm going to keep clicking away here.
Yeah, right. as far as Google Slides goes, it's under what did we say? It was under time, not timing.
Transition.
Okay,
on the little menu bar.
And if your window's too small, you may have to click the little Show More Tools buttons.
Okay.
I ran into that when I have a small window.
Oh, right.
Yeah. Transition is the last one.
Right.
Right, yeah, okay. All right. Well, let me keep searching here, trying to get this set up for her for own use, but I want to be able to kind of get through some of the stuff that she's not into.
Right, no, I understand that. Well done, you. That's very good.
Searching all these things, though. Thank you so much.
All right, thanks, Fred. Thanks again. Bye-bye.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
Okay, we love Fred. Fred is a supporter of the show and a supporter of...
And he feeds us.
It doesn't get a lot better than that, so thank you, Fred. Yeah, the Raspberry Pi is pretty amazing, but it isn't supported by everything yet. Most things, certainly. And again, because it's a Debian variant, the Raspbian is a Debian variant, you can get an amazing array of software for it. But again, not everything. If you actually run real Ubuntu on it, and with the Raspberry Pi 5, you can run Windows on it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why you would, but you could.
Well, I ran into a reverse discrimination issue the other day. The doctor's office with the broken medical scanner, their backup hasn't worked since December. And that was the other error message that they were bypassing. So I said, all right, I'll put another backup program on it. We'll do an offsite backup because that's good anyway. They use Mac Practice management software, and that comes with Dolly Drive offsite backup. Only works on Mac. There's no Windows version of Dolly Drive to put on their X-ray server.
Interesting.
So I'm going to do Backblaze, but
right.
Reverse discrimination program that's Mac only.
Yep. There are so few of those.
Yeah.
All right, back to the phones. Our next caller is Gary from Greece, New York. What's up, Gary?
Top of the day to you.
And the rest of the day for yourself, my friend.
Thank you. I have a question that you probably already have addressed in the past, but I missed it. It has to do with the January update from Windows. There was an error encountered that has to do with the Windows recovery environment. And I have to resize my partition by 250 megabytes. Now, Windows has instructions for it, and I'm just wondering whether I really have to go through that or whether there's something else that I can do.
No, you really need to you go to the disk management window and do it that way.
Make sure you have a good backup first.
Always.
If repartitioning fails, you lose everything.
Exactly. Oh, yeah. But yeah, you follow the instructions. Are they telling you to go through the disk management? Go to storage and then
the
disk management
prompt window.
And which one?
Then go to, for example, reagency/info, and then there's a whole bunch of other command lines to create a new recovery partition.
Okay. Yes. That's a different thing. Yeah. So yes. Follow the instructions exactly. Never hit enter until you're absolutely certain what you've typed in is exactly what you see in the instructions. But you should be fine.
Okay. And on a detail of what you just said, it looks to me like some of the commands seem to have like a space between a quote word unquote and a forward slash. For example, /disable?
It's very possible, yes. One of the things that I suggest people do all the time is they use stupid fonts on the web. So what I suggest people do is they copy and paste it to some sort of notepad-like window that's in Courier. So it's monospaced font.
And you can tell the difference between an O and a zero.
And a one and an L.
Yeah.
So I always suggest people do that, and then if it still looks like there's a problem, you can always move the cursor and see where a space happens.
Okay.
You know, that. Believe me, that's saved my butt more times than I can tell you.
Yeah.
All right. I will give that a shot. And yes, I will back up beforehand.
Yeah.
Twice.
At least.
Yeah. And hope for the best.
Okay.
All right. Good luck.
Let us know how you make out.
Thanks.
Yep. Yeah. That's a pretty good little hint there, is anytime you have to copy something, certainly copy and paste works, but if you want to understand what you're copying and pasting, paste it into a window that's using a monospaced font, like Courier, where ones don't look like L's and zeros don't look like O's, and you can see where spaces are and everything else.
There's usually a space between the command and the argument of that command.
Right, like the slash something.
Right, but not always a space. And in fact, almost never a space in the slash path name.
Right.
So if you have a space in your path name,
you got a problem.
Then you have to put the whole thing in quotes. So I run into issues trying to copy a file from one Windows folder to another Windows folder, and it says path too long. What?
Yeah. All right, back to the phones. Our next caller is Will from Virginia. Where in Virginia, Will?
Hampton.
Hampton, of course it is. How are you?
Wonderful. How are you, panel?
Peachy.
Still this side of the dirt.
All right. That's all you can ask for.
What's up?
So I've been listening to you guys for a number of years, and, of course, the big takeaway that I've gotten from the program is my switch over to Linux. And it's been good thus far. I was using Ubuntu, and then I found out about Zorin, and I switched to Zorin. And I've been following the discussion from the first half hour and what you guys have been mentioning about the importance of updating. And to a certain extent, I've been able to successfully update the software, but once I switched from Windows to Linux, updating hardware was a little bit more of a challenge, particularly the video driver. I have a used Toshiba satellite, which has been really good to me, very fortunately. And it is using the E2100 AMD processor with, Radeon graphics video processor in it. Now, I've been to the AMD website to try to update the driver, but unfortunately with not much success. So I'm wondering if you guys were aware of any resources for updating my now Linux-enabled Toshiba satellite laptop.
Well, in terms of Radeon graphics, there are Radeon drivers in... I'm sorry, I don't know Zorin very well, but I know that in most Linuxes, there are Radeon drivers.
Mm-hmm. Would they come from AMD or from the Linux distributor?
A little of both these days.
Ah.
So what happens is Radeon, the AMD people, have given the Linux people a lot of the underlying code.
Mm-hmm.
And then they build
it. Because they can trust them.
Right, yeah. Right.
How about an update all command?
Well, yeah. But you should be able to say, if I don't know what Zorin is based on, but for example, in any Ubuntu-based...
It's based on Debian.
On Debian, okay. On Debian. So you should be able to say apt-get update sudo apt update.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And that should update everything. That should download all the updates. And then you say sudo apt upgrade, and it actually does the upgrading from the old to the new versions. The answer will be there isn't anything.
There's two steps.
Yeah, so 13.6 is the last of the 13s. So when you say update, there's nothing new.
Right.
But 14 is out now, so you have to say upgrade.
No. Update and upgrade are two parts of the same command. Update says update my database of what's available.
Mm.
And upgrade says take what's new in the database and make it happen.
Ah, okay.
Then you have...
move from like
different on a Mac. Yeah.
To right. 14.
Right.
So presumably that's the most reliable way to update any hardware drivers?
Oh, yeah. Most of your operating, the rest of the stuff in there, whether they've done any updates to any of the other tools that they use within it, it's the two-step process, but it's a good thing to do periodically.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Which I do that periodically, as often as weekly, maybe even a little bit more.
Well, nothing wrong with that. Yeah, that's the thing with Linux. You know, how much time does it really take you? You know, if you start that process, say, before you go to dinner, you can, say get. It'll go ahead and get it. And then you tell it to do the update. You go off to dinner. By the time you come back, it's done. So, you know, it's not like it takes a heck of a long time, but it keeps you up running and running smooth.
You can do update and upgrade combined, I found out.
Yeah, you can. Yeah. I tend not to.
Yeah.
Because I like to read the stuff as it goes
just
by.
In case there's a glitch.
Yeah. But yeah, you can do it either way, and it should work just fine.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to do both update and upgrade.
Of course. Of course.
And what happens is it will do that update sometimes, rarely, but sometimes you will have to reboot. And it may not tell you. So you would just say sudo reboot.
Okay, just to make sure.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, just to make sure. And like I said, you know, I don't bother with.
Even if it didn't, if it does a lot of them, I sit there and go ahead. You know, it doesn't take much. Just say, all right, go ahead, reboot it. Even if it doesn't prompt me to, just in case. You know, what does it take? Well, a few seconds?
Right.
I do tend to try and read, like, some of the diagnostic output to see if it missed something.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
It doesn't seem like it's too often that happens.
Right. Yep. Right. And if you want to upgrade your version, again, in Ubuntu or, I believe, in Debian as well, it's sudo do-release-upgrade.
Say that again, please.
To update the version you're running, like to go from 2004 to 2204, you would say sudo,
mm-hmm.
and then the command do-release-upgrade. And then I think you can add a minus D, and I don't remember what that's for, but it's in my head that there's a minus D.
I guess Steve is going to put that in the program notes for the website.
I can't even find where to look on.
You got him, Will.
I'm sorry.
So was it Zorin auto update like everything?
If you could look at it
on how to update.
Search for upgrading Ubuntu using the command line.
Okay.
Okay.
If you could have seen that, Will, he was giving it a look like a deer in headlights.
I did find an interesting Reddit thread that I was scanning through, and some of it applies to the Mac, and some of it didn't.
Right. First time I've seen Steve in a long time with this blank look, like, huh?
I got one from Fossbytes.
There you go. But yeah, that should do it for you.
Will.
Yeah. Sounds good.
To do that, the do release upgrade.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Man, you guys are a fount of information as usual, and I appreciate you guys.
Well,
Take care, my friend.
Thank you very much. Have fun down there.
Thanks. Enjoy your day.
You too.
Stay safe.
All right, bye.
So, yeah. I have to be honest.
Please.
I have, back in the day, and I mean, you know, 30 years ago, doing a release upgrade was iffy at best.
Mm-hmm.
And I am, to this day, afraid to do it. And I admit that. I have more backups than I can count. And I know how to fix things if they go bad. But doing that release update, just, I sweat.
Am I going to like the new features?
And I want the new features, and I like the new features.
Did they change something?
Right. And I'm using the new features on my laptop because I upgraded that without a single problem. But it just, there's that moment before I hit enter where I just go,
Yeah.
All right, back to the phones. Our next caller is Francis from Webster, New York. Hi, Francis. What's up?
Hi. I just wanted to share a situation I had with iTunes on Windows 11.
Yeah.
My wife and I back up both our phones to the PC, and the last time I went to update, both update and back up her phone, I get a message. It says this version, I know, it says to update your iPhone to iOS 17.4, you need to install the latest version of iTunes. I said, okay. So then I go to update iTunes, and it says this version of iTunes is 12.13.1 is the current version. So, and I, in the meantime, I had scheduled a call from Apple, so they called me. And one of the things they asked, well, did you try on installing it and reinstalling it? So, of course, I thought of that, but I didn't do it. And after three people, while I was on hold, I uninstalled iTunes using Revo. And then I went and searched for app on the Apple website for iTunes. And then I noticed, oh, the version is older than the one I had. So I figured, well, it'll update itself. So I installed that. Then I get a message. There's a file related to iTunes that can't be opened because it was created by a newer version of iTunes. And so I did make a note of the version of iTunes that I had that I deleted, and that was 12.13.1. And then I did a search on the Internet for newer than, and I found 12.13.1.3. And I saw it at Major Deeks, which I've sort of trust, so I downloaded it, and that solved the problem.
Interesting.
Yeah. So don't download iTunes from Apple. And don't download it from the Windows Store, because that's also outdated.
Well, the confusion has come about because Apple has discontinued iTunes, the name.
Exactly.
And they have replaced it with three separate apps like they did on Mac a few years ago.
Right.
There's the music app, the TV app, and the devices app. And so the functions of iTunes to listen to music have been replaced by the Apple Music app. And the function of iTunes to watch TV shows and movies has been replaced by the Apple TV app. The functions of iTunes to back up and sync your phones and iPods, we had someone bring an iPod in, has been replaced with the Apple devices program. So that's what you would need to download in order to sync.
I know eventually I'll have to when iTunes goes away, but in talking to the Apple rep, he was kind of like, yeah, that just came out. I didn't know it was out, but I see it just came out. So I'm a little leery because it says once you download those apps, your music will be gone in iTunes.
And replaced in the music app.
Right.
So it's just the name of the program is changing. They did that on the Mac a couple of years ago, and it's throwing everybody off, too.
Okay.
And the apps themselves have been out since September, but Apple took off their preview flag, and so now they're officially released.
Oh, okay. So I'll probably download that and solve the problem completely.
Yeah. Especially if you don't listen to Apple Music on your Windows PC. You don't necessarily need the music half of the app.
Right, and of course the instructions say you must download all three.
Of course they do.
And then the question is why, but they never answer the why. You know, they never give you why you need to do that. And he was guessing, but the person I spoke to at Apple, but he didn't really know why. He said he didn't think he would have to download all three. But I guess I could download one and see what happens.
Sure.
I would need the music, and for my own use, I'd need the music and the devices.
Right.
But we don't have Apple TV. The problem I do have with iTunes, and it happened quite a while back, and all the DVDs I download into iTunes, they are in iTunes, but I can't see them on my phone, even when I do a sync. It doesn't carry the DVDs over to the phone anymore.
What
it used to.
What format are they in? They probably have to be H.263 or H.264.
Yeah, I would have to research that. Yeah. All right, that's another subject.
All right, we got to go.
All righty, thanks.
All right, thank you very much. All right, that music tells us that the first hour of this show is history, but history is going to repeat itself because there's a whole nother hour of the longest running computer show in the known universe coming your way. That's right. The unmitigated joy of another hour of Dave Enright, the unmitigated something of another hour of Steve Ray and me, Nick Francesco, and of course all of you. 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free 800-790-0415. Take a bio break, grab yourself something to refresh yourself with, and we'll be back in just a couple of minutes with sound bites on member supported Jazz 90.1. See you in a few.
Before you call into our show, please make note of the following rules. 1. Turn your radio down. 2. Turn your radio down lower. 3. Remember, nobody has invented a good-sounding speakerphone yet. Don't use them. 4. Make sure you have a point. It makes for a more interesting show. 5. Calling does not guarantee you'll get on the air. No whining. 6. If you do get on the air, please do not tell the host what you just told the screener. We don't care. And 7. Is that radio turned down yet? We hope this will make for a more enjoyable program, and we thank you for your time.
It's America's longest-running computer show. Back to more sound bites with Nick, Dave, and Steve. Next on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
WGMC Greece Rochester, a public service of the Greece Central School District. Jazz 90.1.
Celebrating 50 years on the air in Rochester.
Welcome back to America's longest-running computer show, Soundbites, on member-supported Jazz 90.1. Get online now. Call 966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free 800-790-0415. Or submit your question by email at soundbites.org. Once again, here's Nick Francesco, Dave Enright, and Steve Ray on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Steve Ray.
And it's 6 minutes after the hour. You are hurtling headlong into the second hour of the longest-running computer show in the known universe, Soundbites. This past Tuesday was Microsoft's March 2024 Patch Tuesday, and security updates have been released for 60 vulnerabilities, including 18 remote code execution flaws. Those are the bad ones. The Patch Tuesday fixes only two critical vulnerabilities, Hyper-V remote code execution and denial of service flaws. The number of bugs in each vulnerability category is 24 elevation of privilege vulnerabilities, 3 security feature bypass vulnerabilities, 18 remote code execution vulnerabilities, 6 information disclosure vulnerabilities, 6 denial of service vulnerabilities, and 2 spoofing vulnerabilities. The total count of 60 flaws does not include 4 Microsoft Edge flaws, which were fixed back on March 7th. This month's Patch Tuesday does not fix any zero-day vulnerabilities, but does include some interesting flaws like a Microsoft Office Elevation of Privilege vulnerability or a Microsoft Defender Security Feature Bypass vulnerability. Yes, they can bypass the antivirus. So, never mind. Or a remote code execution vulnerability in Skype. Every time you use Skype, someone can take over your computer. So if you use any of these products, or if you're using Windows itself, you should upgrade. How safe do you feel with Windows? Give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. It's 966-5299. Toll free 800-790-0415.
And so you hope that when you upgrade to the latest version, it doesn't break something else, because you really need these updates.
You really need them.
What I want to know is how long were they out there before they got around to patching them?
Yep.
Most of them are.
Exactly. Microsoft is not fast at patching things. It's one of the other things I love about Linux, and I keep harping on this. I read a lot of here's the latest bugs, here's the latest problem. Mm-hmm. A day later, I get an update for that product for Linux. People are that fast. They want secure software, and they insist on it, and they make it happen.
Well, that's like I was telling you, and I've been talking about this one software package that I've been using, and they were doing a rewrite and getting away from Microsoft Access.
Yep.
The guy was able to, just this past week, pull up a demo of what he's rewritten. He's rewritten it from the ground up using SQLite. SQLite.
Yep.
And talk about speed. It's unbelievable. This guy was looking through 110,000 records of information, and these are multiple fields, and he could type it in, some a call sign in or something like that, boom, pops right up. Goes to the next one, boom. Whereas with the old Microsoft Access, go get a cup of coffee and come back. It's unbelievable.
Access is slow. One of the things about Access is it's slow.
That's an understatement.
It was great in the day when people didn't have huge databases and you had professional products like Postgres SQL and MySQL. But if you just wanted a quick, fast, you know, I've got 200 records, 400 records.
It fit on a floppy disk.
It fit on a floppy disk. It was fine for that. And this was in the days before SQLite, which does all of that so much better. But back in the day, it was fine. But when you start using it for 10,000, 20,000, 50,000 records, it's what's the technical term? Crap.
Yeah.
It's crap. So, yeah.
That's an understatement.
Yeah.
There was a episode of Security Now recently where someone had written Steve a question about it was just a guy. He happened to discover a vulnerability on the website of a multi-billion-dollar company with hundreds of millions of active users. They're using an outdated Nginx with known vulnerabilities. So he said he searched all over their website trying to find who to report vulnerabilities to, couldn't find anything. So he eventually reported to, you know, like generic customer service. He got a canned answer back. All right, we'll look at it.
Yeah.
You know, 6 months later, nothing had ever been changed. The vulnerability is still there. So the guy's saying, what should I do? Because he's afraid that if he goes public, they're going to, you know, sue him, arrest him.
Sure.
Because that has happened in the past. And so, you know, Steve said, all right, well, send it to CERT, the Computer Emergency Response Team, and let the U.S. government talk to this multi-billion-dollar company about known vulnerabilities on their website that are actively exploited.
Right.
That'll probably get their attention.
Yeah.
Might.
Yeah.
Now, I have to tell you, there is DB Engines has a ranking system for database management systems according to their popularity.
Uh-huh.
dbengines.com/en/ranking. And Microsoft Access is number 11.
Jeez.
Oracle number one, and it's been number one for, yeah, I believe, 2,000 or 3,000 years.
Where's FileMaker?
Second is MySQL. FileMaker is like 21. But this is in order of popularity, which has a lot to do with a lot of its legacy.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, people have been using FileMaker for 100 years. People have been using Access for 100 years. They just haven't changed anything.
Well, because they don't have the resources to redo it. It takes a lot. This guy has been working on this program for over a year, rewriting it from the ground up. And it's, well, once he showed a lot of us this, the demo of the new MySQL database, everybody's applauding him and everything else, saying this is well worth the wait, because that has been the biggest problem with this program, was searching through thousands of records.
Yeah.
It was dog butt slow.
I did some testing a couple of years ago now of MySQL and SQLite and Microsoft Access, MariaDB, and a couple of others, Postgres, Oracle, and they pretty much match what I'm seeing here. Oracle was super fast. MySQL was almost as fast. So was Maria. So was Postgres. Access was terribly slow. Maria. SQLite was super fast.
Well, I once had Maria, a database named Maria.
Isn't Maria an SQLite? Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's essentially MySQL.
Yeah.
It's a rewrite of MySQL. And essentially so is SQLite. The big difference is SQLite doesn't need a separate server. It actually just puts a file on your database, on your computer. So this thing lists, and this is the most popular, not the fastest or the best or whatever, because nothing is best. Everything is best for a particular type of application. But this is what's most popular. and Oracle will always remain the most popular because it can do 100 quintillion records without breathing heavily. Microsoft, MySQL is right behind it because it does the same. Microsoft SQL Servers is third because so many Windows programs simply use it and you don't get another choice.
Well, there was another thing about this switching is now, before with the old Microsoft, trying to share a database between other radios, you know, or other PCs, he couldn't do it. You had to copy it from one, move it over to this one, and paste it into that program. There was no way that it wanted to work correctly by putting, say, a database up on a cloud,
right,
or on a server, and having all these PCs go into one database. It
right.
was sloppy, slow, and very inefficient.
The other thing about Microsoft Access is only half a dozen languages that support it. For SQLite, there's like 20. So, yeah. You know.
Yeah, that's a few.
So if you want to write your program in C or C Sharp or Visual Basic, you can use either. But if you want to write it in Java or JavaScript or Forth or Python or PHP.
Far more.
Right, right. SQLite will do it for you, so will MySQL and a number of others. So, you know, Microsoft Access, again, back in the day, was one of the few databases that was easy to use for a non-relational database
manager. Unlike DBase.
Right, right, right. Or Oracle or PostgreSQL, right? So, you know, and it was visual. Because, you know, they all do this now.
It was the best thing since sliced bread back in its day.
And, again, people didn't have 200,000 or 2 million records.
Yeah.
So Microsoft Access was fine for what it did. But it's too slow now.
Because of the way people are collecting data.
Right.
I mean, they're collecting data at a massive amount and, you know, plugging through all this information like they're grabbing from the web. If you don't think they are, think of it, folks. When you go and, say, search on something, and then all of a sudden in your Chrome browser, all of a sudden you're getting inundated with all those ads from the stuff that you were just looking up. Even though you've already purchased it, you're still going to get inundated for at least another month of, say, you looked up car insurance. Bam, you're going to get ads and everything else from car insurance people's for because they're pulling in all this information and then spitting it back out at millions and millions of people.
Right.
I remember reading the original Jurassic Park book, 1995, somewhere in there. And they talked about, well, first we need a database that can hold 3 billion records.
Right.
Where the hell are we going to find that?
Right, back in the day, right.
Back in the day,
you certainly weren't going to do it in Access.
Yeah.
You could do it in Oracle.
Yeah. This is Unix. I know this.
I know this. And that was about it. But now, you know, you can do millions and millions of records in many of these databases. The point becomes how fast are they going to be?
Yeah.
And like you've seen, SQLite and MariaDB and MySQL, which are all free to use databases, are now super fast, and Access just isn't. The Jet
engine
is not
fast. And they're so simple. That was the other big thing that he was pointing out, that trying to keep up with Microsoft and the changes that they kept doing, and some of these changes were stupid changes, made no sense, and messed things up.
Yep.
So by going to the MySQL, it just works. And it works darn efficiently.
Right. And the other thing that was good about Access is it had a graphical front end. It was easy to write a database. It was easy to create relations among the database. Now there's 50 million programs that do the same thing for other types of databases.
Mm-hmm.
There's the DB server not DB server. What's it called? Do I have it installed here? I do not. But there are many for SQLite. There are many for MySQL. So you can, you know, create what used to be the cutting edge thing for Microsoft Access was that GUI. Now you can get GUIs for everything. So it's pretty easy to create a new database with that. And there, like I said, there are just a lot of front ends available for it. I use Beekeeper. I used to use Beaver. Now I use Beekeeper.
Jason Statham
will come to your home and create a database for you. It's very cool. Actually.
I opened a computer the other day that was extra GUI with, we think, Coke, maybe. No wonder the fan doesn't spin.
What did you spill in here? Nothing. Yeah, okay. Yeah.
What did someone around you spill in it? Yeah.
You're right. But yeah, so there are an amazing number of databases that are available, and people use what's familiar and what may be already installed on their system. If you bought the professional version of Microsoft Office, you have access. And if your database is fewer than a few hundred entries, it's going to work just fine for you.
And some people don't realize what a database is.
Right.
Your address book is a database.
Your contact list.
Your contact list, yeah. A lot of people use Excel as a simple database because at its root, a database is a list of data.
Right.
And, you know, rows and columns, you know, make records and lists. And I always get a kick out of there's a database view in Excel that hides the rows and columns and just shows you the record.
Right.
With all the cells on a single page. So that just shows you the record, next record, previous record. Sometimes it's easier to look at the whole list and.
Right.
Even now, in our FileMaker database, sometimes it's easiest to look at in list view, so you can see all the data.
And again, no shame. Excel works.
Yeah.
Excel and any spreadsheet works as a database program. It's not efficient. It's not fast. But again, for a couple of hundred records, it's not really a problem.
Yeah. The early versions had a 16,000 record limit.
Right.
Was it 16,184?
And if you got to 16,184 records, it was slow.
Yeah.
It was very slow. And a lot of people used the mail merge function, which essentially let Word use Excel as a database.
Yep.
And again, that works, and it works fine. You really don't want to do it with 50,000 records, but you can certainly do it.
Yeah.
You know, if you're gonna do 50,000 records, if you want to search and sort and stuff like that. Back in the day when we were both, for our various user groups, sending out huge mailings, you sort them by zip code, you sort them by town, you sort them, you know, in various different ways. And doing that on Microsoft Access could get slow.
We used to have label parties where we'd
label
until the one day the guy brought the six-pack of Triple Bock and we couldn't invite him anymore.
Yeah.
The post office rejected our mailing because the labels were too crooked.
Too crooked.
which was interesting because we managed to look it up. They can be a little crooked. I think it's 1 or 2 degrees, but it can't be too crooked.
Right, because they're being read by a machine.
Yeah.
Like a 45-degree angle.
Yep. Yeah.
So then we had to put a straight line on the printout so that you could line your mailing label up.
Yeah. but yeah, so, you know, those things will work. Are they the most efficient? Maybe you don't care. And that's fair. Yeah. You know, if you've got a program that's printing out 1,000 letters to mail out to people and you're doing mail merge for that and you don't care that it takes half an hour or 2 hours to print, fine. Use it. It's perfectly acceptable. But if you're doing, you know, if you're searching 150,000 records and you've got deadlines
and, don't complain.
And time constraints, you want a real database program. And Access kind of isn't anymore.
And every time you see on TV where they're searching a fingerprint database or a facial recognition database, we always cringe. Showing the data as you search it is so much slower.
So slow. So slow. I actually did a test for that a number of years ago for somebody as well. And it was like 6,000% slower.
Yeah.
To you know, put up each record as why? Why would you do that? Who cares?
If it's not the relevant, why do you need to see it?
Because it makes good television.
Right.
Yeah, that's the graphics.
We can even do that on I made a simple for loop, count to a million.
Yeah.
And you hit enter and it's done. If you say print the number as it counts it, takes forever.
Takes forever. Even if you just print like dots.
Yeah.
But that's why with graphical user interfaces, you just put up a spinner and say working and just let it happen in the background.
Let it go. And then I read an interesting essay on progress bars. Should you put a progress bar up? Because they're always wrong.
They're always wrong.
If you're going to copy 1,000 files, if the first file takes 10 minutes, well, then I'm just going to multiply by 999. That's how long it's going to take. Well, that's too long. If I do a bunch of small files, that takes longer. If I do a big file, it goes a big file faster than doing small. So that's why when you're watching a progress bar, it goes up and down and up and down. The estimates are – and when it says less than a minute remaining, it's really lying.
Yeah, don't believe me.
And it sits we're just about done.
I want to know
5 minutes later.
I want to know that it's working. So I don't want just, you know, a spinning cursor.
Right.
Because is it stuck or is it working?
Right.
But so a progressing progress bar. So sometimes I'll put my cursor at the end of the bar. It moved. It's still working. It hasn't frozen.
What the progress bars I don't mind are, let's say I have 100 files to move. Each file is 1%.
Mm-hmm.
And it just moves that way, saying the number of files that are copied, not the time.
Right.
That makes sense to me.
So it goes 1, 2, 3, 7, 8, 9, 100.
Right.
Yeah.
Because some files copy very quickly and some copy. If you're copying a movie from one disk to another, it takes forever.
Yep. Yeah.
If you're copying a text
file you wrote,
it just moves. So, and that's one of the problems people have always had with computers. They lie all the time. All the time. But if you're looking for easy to use, simple database for a couple of hundred records, Access is fine. But if you're looking for something that's enterprise worthy, SQLite will do you for any mid-sized company, and MySQL will work for large companies. And you don't have to, you know, pay for Oracle or PostgreSQL. Well, that's free too. But any of those will do the job, and do the job fairly quickly and easily. The first time I used SQLite for a project, I thought to myself, "This is going to be terrible. I'm going to have to convince them to get a server, set up a server for MySQL." And then I did the first test on, 100,000 records, and I thought, it didn't work. It was too fast. It didn't work.
You hit return, and it says done. What? Yeah. No. That's impossible.
Then I looked at the result, and it was all there.
I just blinked. Yeah. That's all I did. Blinked, and it's done.
Yeah. I do like SQLite very much. It's a little harder to set up unless you use one of those little graphical front-end things for it, which you can easily download and use. But once, look, I've been programming databases since the days where they were all done by hand. So, I'll sit there and write a, insert and create. And
I used to joke, I think it was DBase 3, when you boot the floppy disk, it says press return to accept the license.
Yeah.
If you waited long enough, it continued anyway.
Yeah.
I never accepted the license for DBase 3.
The first time I saw DBase, I started to drool. I love databases.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that was...
What a great program.
Yeah, but the other big thing that, for me, what I like about the SQLite...
Where's DBase in this ranking?
Is, again...
Yes.
Because...
43!
Most folks, when they create a database, they want to share it with other people.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And putting it on a server... And then letting multiple people access it, they might not all be accessing the same one. You might have one person, say, coming into the financial end of it, some others doing it. It can handle that. And it doesn't slow down. And it does it very accurately.
Right.
So if you update a record, it's reflected instantly.
Yep.
Because it is so efficient.
Yep.
And it will work. Like I say, with different people, they don't all have to be sitting on that one computer. It's multiple computers hitting one database, and it makes it so much easier.
Makes it so much easier.
DBase was released in 1979.
Yes, it was.
Is there anything older still around?
That I do not know.
Well, the latest update was in 2019.
Yep. It's not that far.
And it's still, yeah, it's still 40, ranks 43 on that ranking list.
Yep. Again, that's popularity.
Yeah.
Not ability.
Yeah.
So
still being used after 40 years.
Exactly. All right. We're going to take a quick break, but we will be back in just a couple of minutes with Dave Enright, with Steve Ray, with me, Nick Francesco, and with you. It is 29 minutes after the hour. You're listening to the longest running computer show in the known universe. That would be Soundbites. Right here on the truly great and truly grateful to you that we are member-supported Jazz 90.1. See you in a couple.
Computer talk you can understand. More Sound Bites is next on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Steve Ray.
And at 34 minutes after the hour, we are Sound Bites. And yes, tomorrow is St. Patrick's Day, so top of the afternoon to all of you. And the rest of the day for myself. Yeah. Gosh, and Begora. I don't know that I've ever met an Irish person who actually ever said Begora, ever, in my life. Anyway, on Thursday, the Federal Communications Commission voted to raise its internet speed benchmark for the first time since January of 2015, concluding that modern broadband service should provide at least 100 megabits download speeds and 20 megabits upload speeds. An FCC press release after the 3-2 vote said the 100 megabit, 20 megabit per second benchmark is based on the standards now used in multiple federal and state programs, such as those used to distribute funding to expand networks. The new benchmark also reflects consumer usage patterns and what is actually available from and marketed by internet service providers, the FCC said. The previous standard of 25 megabits downstream and 3 megabits upstream lasted through the entire Trump era and most of President Biden's term. There had been a clear partisan divide on the speed standard, with Democrats pushing for higher benchmark and Republicans arguing that it shouldn't be raised. The standard is partly symbolic but can indirectly impact potential FCC regulations. The FCC is required under U.S. law to regularly regulate whether advanced telecommunications... I beg everyone's pardon. Advanced telecommunications capability. I should have gone to bed. Thank you. No, that's it. I should have gotten some sleep last night. That probably would have helped. Advanced telecommunications capability is being deployed to all Americans in a reasonable and timely fashion, and to take immediate action to accelerate deployment and promote competition if current deployment is not reasonable and timely. Thursday's 3-2 vote approved the 100 megabit, 20 megabit per second standard, and a report concluding that advanced telecommunications capability is not being deployed in a reasonable and timely fashion. The conclusion is, based on the total number of Americans in rural areas and people living in tribal lands who lack access to such capability and the fact that these gaps in deployment are not closing rapidly enough, the press release said. Based on data from December of 2022, the FCC said that fixed broadband service, excluding satellite, has not been physically deployed to approximately 24 million Americans, including almost 28% of Americans in rural areas and more than 23% of people living on tribal lands. A draft of the FCC report was released before the meeting. Based on our evaluation of available data, we can no longer conclude that broadband speeds of 25.3 megabits, the fixed benchmark established in 2015 and relied on in the last 7 reports, supports advanced functions, the report said. We find that having advanced telecommunications capability for fixed broadband service requires access to download speeds of at least 100 megabits per second and upload speeds of at least 20 megabits per second. The record overwhelmingly supports increasing the fixed speed benchmark in this manner. The report also sets a long-term speed goal of 1 gigabit per second download speeds, compared with 500 megabit upload speeds. The FCC said it intends to use this speed goal as a guidepost for evaluating our efforts to encourage deployment. So is your internet access fast enough? Give us a call. 585-966-JAZZ. It's 966-5299. Toll free 800-790-0415. It's a pretty high standard comparatively these days.
Yeah. I remember another recent Security and Outback. They talk about interesting things. Somebody asked, why wasn't the internet designed with security in mind?
There were six machines on the internet.
Right.
That's why.
And it wasn't going to catch on.
And there was no security at the protocols at the time. You know, what became the public key infrastructure, the Diffie-Hellman key exchange, was mid-70s.
Right.
Internet came out and started being developed in the early 50s. So we didn't have a way to encrypt anything. There was no encryption yet.
Right. And the whole idea of the internet was the open exchange of information.
Yeah.
It was originally designed so that academic and government institutions could freely exchange data.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't designed to send email or pictures or porn or any of that stuff. It was specifically designed to say, hey, I wrote this great scientific paper. Here's a copy.
After 10 years of research and then some guy on the internet says bull.
Here's bull. Right.
But yeah, and adding encryption to allow for purchasing, that was Netscape in, what, the mid-80s?
Mid-80s.
Yeah. And so it's not that they didn't think of it at the time. There just wasn't any.
Right,
it's
exactly.
Time.
So the bad guys keep ruining everything for us.
Doggone them. All right, back to the phones. Our next caller is Rich from Irondequoit, New York. What's up, Rich?
Good morning or good afternoon. I keep seeing an ad online. I think I can't recall it. It's two letters for $1.99, and you get all of this virus protection. I'm sure you guys know what I'm referring to. It's just two letters, and it sounds pretty good.
Well,
ring a bell?
No.
No, I'm sorry. Without a name, I don't know what to tell you. But
okay, I tried looking it up.
Yeah.
Okay,
short answer is you don't need to pay for anything. There are plenty of good free antivirus programs.
AVG.
Yeah, they've all escaped my mind at the moment.
Right.
Most of them do have commercial versions if you want to contribute to them. But I almost I wouldn't trust anything that advertised on television.
Yeah, right. Exactly right.
It's online. What did you say? BMG?
AVG.
AVG I have had.
Yeah,
okay.
AVG and Avast, they're in a weird position now. One of them bought the other one, and they just got fined by, might have been the EU.
Probably.
One of their VPN products was caught saving information and selling your private information. They said they weren't going to sell. So the problem wasn't they sold it. They said they weren't going to sell it and did.
I paid for AVG. I have paid for it, and they keep asking me if I want extra services and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, everyone keeps coming up with newer
upselling
services.
Is how they make their money.
Yeah, and we don't like the idea of one program trying to do everything anyway.
Right.
We like a separate AV program, a separate malware program, a separate malware device and super anti-spyware, because they look at different places. And so one program can't do it all.
Right.
And if they try, it doesn't do anything very good.
That's good advice right there. Separate programs for individual bad guys.
Yeah.
Thank you, guys.
All right. Thanks, Rich. Yeah, even on Linux, I'm using ClamAV and RK Hunter and a couple of others that do the different things and let me. Feel more safe and more secure.
Mm-hmm.
I really like Rootkit Hunter. It does exactly what it says. It searches out rootkits.
Yep.
On your computer. On my machine, it's set every time I download something, an update, even just an update from known good sources.
Yeah.
It runs and says, no, you're clean. So that's pretty nice.
So if that commercial he saw was for like $1.99 a month, $25 a year is pretty common for most of the commercial AV suites.
Right.
So when they break it down into monthly fees, it's only $1.99 a month.
Yeah, yeah. And that's, $1.99 a month isn't bad. And he's right about that, for a couple of bucks a month to get secure and to get
safe. How important is your data to you?
Exactly. And that's, why we tell people, it's great that you have things like pCloud that have a one-time payment, which is a lot of money, but it's a one-time payment for a lifetime subscription and things like that. When you break it out for how long you use it and how many times you use it and how many days you use it and how safe it keeps you, It's not expensive at all. You know, you buy insurance for a lot of things. This is insurance. Backups are insurance against the day when, not if, your computer will die.
And the biggest threat these days is mostly from fake virus warning messages that come from ads on websites. And no software can stop that because they don't know it's fake or not.
Right.
So you have to be vigilant. Keep in mind that if you don't have an AV software running, and you should. So if you get a message saying that Windows Security has found a problem and you're running Norton.
It's a fake message.
Or you get one that says Norton and you're running AVG. Because the bad guys will use the names of known programs to try to trick you.
Right.
The more dire it is, the faker it is. So flashing lights and a voice saying, don't shut your computer off or everything's going to get deleted.
Right.
No, those are all fake. Close the window. Close the browser. Turn off the computer. Wait a minute. You got lucky enough to be the first one to see that ad.
Right.
In a few minutes, the networks will have found the problem and taken it away.
Right. So... Most of the time when you see these ads, A, don't panic. Mm-hmm. No, excuse me. A, don't click on anything.
Mm-hmm.
B, don't panic. And C, check independently. So, like I said, I get the second most common email I get is there's a problem with your bank account.
Mm-hmm.
The most common is I'm a lovely young woman in your area and I would like to meet you. That I completely understand is real, but as far as the who wouldn't want to meet me? So as far as the bank,
it's that Chrome go,
yeah, right. It's the beard. As far as the banking stuff goes, when I get a message like that, even if most of the time it's not for my bank, so it's just I throw it away. If it is for my bank, I go independently to the link I've already saved in my browser for my bank. And look, if there's a problem, I will get a notice. I will get a notice on screen from the banking site I already bookmarked.
Right.
I did not click on anything in the email or the ad.
One other thing that you could try.
Yeah.
And this might make you feel a little more secure, is that device that you're holding in your hand is still called a telephone.
Yeah.
You can actually call your bank and talk to a live person.
Wait, what now?
Call the number on the physical
card. Yeah, they'll answer.
Yeah, call the number on the physical card in your wallet. Don't call the number on the screen.
Do not ever call the number on the screen. No. Do not click on the link on the screen
from your bank statement or whatever, or the credit card, you just dial that number and you can talk to a live person and they'll look up your account and they'll answer any questions you have and stay on the phone until you feel, I've got nothing to worry about.
Yep.
Unfortunately, sometimes that's not enough. We had a customer who got the email that Frontier is switching their email servers to Yahoo. And you need to change your computer. So for anyone who still uses Frontier email with an email program like Thunderbird or Windows Mail or Apple Mail, you need to change the server settings in your computer. So they got this email, were unsure, so they called Frontier, and Frontier says, yeah, that's true, you have to do that. So then they click the link in the email and are taken to a fake website where they lose their email password. So the bad guys are getting smarter.
Yep.
They know this is happening. They know people are going to be expecting this message. So the content of the message was true. This is really happening. But the links in it were fake.
Yep.
And that's really insidious.
It is very insidious.
Yeah.
This thing is really happening. You really need to do it. But not that message. The other message really came from Frontier.
Well, we've said for decades, it's a game of leapfrog.
Yep.
You know, they find ways to get around something. The programmers and everybody else try to find ways to block them. And then they find a way around that. And it's been going on for decades.
I think that's one place where AI is giving the bad guys a leg up. Because it used to be bad grammar and bad spelling were clues that this was a fake email. But now you ask an AI to generate an email, you know, fake email message. Well, you ask it to generate a message about you have a virus infection, and you get a nice, perfectly grammatically correct message. You can mm-hmm. send an email out to everyone.
Yep. Yeah, but you know what? Generally speaking, be a cynic.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, but be a cynic. Definitely make sure that you have a healthy skepticism for everything you read in an mm-hmm. email or on the web. And think of an alternate way to find out whether that information is correct. Generally speaking, you can trust the website that you independently know of. So, you know, ask your bank what their website is and then bookmark it.
Yeah.
You know, that way you know you are going to your real bank's website. And if you get an email that comes from somewhere else, I got a very, very official looking email the other day that came from someplace.ru. That's Russia. Pretty sure my bank doesn't have any servers in Russia.
You think?
Pretty sure. So, you know, it looked good. It looked good. Again, I went to my saved URL, my bookmark, and opened up my bank, which I do twice a day anyway, just to check and see what's going on. No message, mm-hmm. no nothing. So, yep, it's fake.
But most of the time, your bank or credit card companies will send postal mail.
Right.
Because that's a federal crime to send fake postal mail.
Right.
Easier to catch them at the other end, too.
Right.
But yeah, so you can almost always trust postal mail. Right. And the stuff they're trying to sell you is probably true, but it's still, a lot of people still think it's junk and don't want that mail, but mm-hmm. at least that stuff is true. It's not the fake timeshare sale you get on the phone.
Right. So, yeah, if you've got, you can often trust snail mail. Not always, but often. Oh, there was one other thing I wanted to talk about today. This fascinated me. It's fairly inside baseball and geeky and in the weeds, and I get that. But what happens is there's a couple of researchers who say they have figured out a way to almost double the speed of a computer without any physical changes. And it has to do with the way that they thread multitasking in the operating system. Now, you're not going to see this soon because every company's got to A, decide they want to do this, and B, then write it. So it's going to be a while before we see this. But they were saying with the tests they did, because you have multiple cores, multiple CPUs in your computer.
Doing tests.
Like cylinders in an engine. The more cylinders you have in your car engine, the more powerful the engine is.
Right. And so you now get, you know, 4-core or 8-core or 16-core computers. Plus you have a GPU for graphical processing. You often have a TPU. So you've got, you know, multiple cores in your machine, multiple CPUs, multiple computers inside your computer. And what the scientists did was break up the tasks in a kind of a new way called simultaneous and heterogeneous multithreading, or SHMT. And what they did was they took apart all of the commands, all of the programs, and ran them separately on all these different processors. Because generally speaking, when you have multiple processors, any one program only ever uses one processor, generally speaking. And so what this does is it breaks up a program to use multiple processors simultaneously, which means that instead of something happening at speed one, if you use two processors, it works at speed two. At three processors, it works at speed three. And et cetera, et cetera. Now, there's overhead and there's time spent breaking it up and putting it back together. But even so, they can double the speed. They doubled the speed of all the programs they ran. So it is not impossible that in the future, you will get an update to a program like Linux or possibly even Windows that will, or the Mac OS, that will suddenly make your computer seem twice as fast as it was. Mm-hmm. Now, will it really be twice as fast? No, because they're not going to be able to change the speed at which you save data to or get data from your hard drive.
Just be more efficient in the way that it does.
Yeah. It'll just be more efficient in how it processes it when you get it. So depending on what you do, it'll be faster or at least some faster.
I
just was fascinated by that.
It sounds pretty cool. My first thought was Spectre and Meltdown.
Yep.
When predictive processing. So when there's a decision your computer has to make, you know, yes or no, it sends both instruction paths down a separate core or separate thread usually. And if the answer turns out to be yes, it throws away the no answer.
Right.
So by speculative execution, it can run faster because it's doing both things at once and then only using the thing it needs. So in the Spectre and Meltdown vulnerabilities, it's possible to use that data left over that isn't used to predict what the next data is going to be, and it's a way, you know, theoretically break into computers. So these unintended consequences.
Right.
So yeah. So if we have to make a decision, let's just do both and see what happens. All right. Now we're going to break it down into multi-threads. So that's multi-threads. Is that going to make it faster to get broken into?
Right.
So and the speculative execution took about 20 years before someone realized there was an issue. Or there could be an issue.
Right. Well, this is different.
Yeah.
This is different. What it does is it figures out how to break up the program so that rather than sending the same data to two things, you send different data to different cores. And so if you've got an 8-core machine or a 16-core machine, you may not get the efficiency of that depending on what operating system you're using. But with this new feature, you would. So, you know, if the operating system is twice as fast, then everything else you do is going to be much faster, maybe not twice.
Yep.
But much faster, and the only slow part is going to be the writing and reading of data. And that's pretty fast these days with solid-state drives. So, you know, it's not as bad a thing. I just, that kind of fascinated me because it means you don't have to buy new hardware.
Yeah. Yeah. There's an interesting benchmarking program called Cinebench from Maxon, which makes video cards. And so it tests your video card by rendering a screen. And it shows you which bit of the image each graphics core is currently rendering. So if you have a 4-core graphics thing, you see 4 little bits filling in at once. If you have an 8-core graphics card, you see 8 things filling in at once. And it's really neat watching it fill in this whole graphic and visually seeing how much faster this graphics card is than this graphics card.
Nice.
And it's amazing.
Cinebench?
Cinebench, yeah. I'm going to post a link to it. It runs on, I know it runs on Mac and Windows. It might run on Unix, too.
So, yeah. Oh, Cinebench. Probably not. No, I can't use that. I've stopped using the trackpad on my laptop because the way I sit, and this never happens on any other machine, but on this machine, the way I sit, how low I am, I keep hitting the trackpad and moving the cursor. So I've added a mouse, but now I'm not used to it.
Yeah, it looks like it's Windows x86, Windows ARM, or Mac OS.
Yeah. Oh, well. Too bad for me.
But their database of graphics cards is amazing. When you're running it, it shows you other people's reported speeds on their graphics card.
Nice. Most of us don't need super fast. There are some things that you would do if you're rendering images and stuff like that, playing a game, certainly.
Yeah.
You would need it, but you know, for many people, it's not a super requirement. Anyway, that's it. We're done for another week. I want to thank everybody who called in. We had good questions this week. I want to thank everybody who called in. I want to thank everybody who didn't call in. I want to thank Dave Enright, Steve Ray. I'm Nick Francesco. You've been listening to the longest running computer show in the known universe. And that's right here on the truly great and truly grateful to you, because it is only with your support that we remain on the air, because we are truly and solely member supported. That's Jazz 90.1. That's who you've been listening to for the last couple of hours and hopefully listen to all week. But we'll be back next week with a whole lot more sound bites right here. We will see you in just 166 hours. Be good to one another, will you?